नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय So before beginning the recitation of Srimad Bhagavatam this morning, I'd just like to say that there are so many special souls that came and are coming to the Krishna consciousness movement, and hearing the Brahmananda Prabhu's passing yesterday was very moving experience for me. Always sort of idolized him. And still do, passing in Vrindavan the way he did. So we'll, as Keshe Prabhu said, we'll have a ceremony sometime. That's something to look forward to, glorifying these devotees that first came to serve Srila Prabhupada and did so much to establish where we are and what we can accomplish even to this day in Srila Prabhupada's service. So today we're reading concluding verses of the 66th chapter of the 10th canto, Vondraka, the False Vasudev, texts 41 through 43. So we'll chant together text number 41. So word meanings, Chakram, the disc, Cha, and Vishnu, of Lord Vishnu, Tat, it, the fire demon, Anupravishtam, entering in pursuit, Varanasim, Varanasi, Sa, with Atta, raised porches, Shabha, its assembly halls, Alaya, residences, Apana, and marketplaces, Sa, with Gopura, gateways, Atataka, watchtowers, Kosta, and warehouses, Sankulam, crowded, Sa, with Kosha, banks, Hasti, for elephants, Ashva, horses, Rata, chariots, Anna, and grains, Salimim, with the buildings. Chakram to Vishnu Tadanu Pravishtam. Varanasim Sata Sabhalayam Sabha Yalpanam. Sago Purata Laka Kosta Sankalam. Sago Purata Laka Kosta Sankalam. Sakosta Hastavasatana Salinim. Chakram Javishnostaranu Pravistam. Varanasim sata sahayapanam. Sagoparata laka kosta shankulam. Sakosahasya vasavatana savinim. Chakram cha Vishnu staranu pavistam. Varanasim sata sakalaya panam. Sago purata lakla kosa sankulam. Sakosta hastava. Ratana Salim. Ratana So Gopara Kala Kosta Sankulam. So Kosta Hastasvavratanam Salinim. Chakram cha Vishno Staranupavistam. Varanasim Sata Savalaya Rapanam. Sagoparata Lakakosa Sankulam. Sukosta Hasjaspa Ratana Salini. Ladies? Chakram cha Vishno Staranupavistam. Translation by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada. So I'll just read 41 through 43, and then we'll discuss the subject matters. There are no purports to either any of these verses today. So the text 41 begins with, and also, so just for those of you who may not have been following the story, a fiery demon was created to harass and ultimately kill Krishna and the residents of Dwarka. That demon's efforts were thwarted, and so that fiery demon came back to Varanasi and there killed Sudakshina, who had conjured him up with his priests, and so he killed Sudakshina and all his priests. And following that fiery demon back to Varanasi was Lord Vishnu's disc. So therefore we have Lord Vishnu's disc also entered Varanasi in pursuit of the fiery demon and proceeded to burn the city to the ground, including all its assembly halls and residential palaces with raised porches, its numerous marketplaces, gateways, watchtowers, warehouses, and treasuries, and all the buildings housing elephants, horses, chariots, and grains. After burning down the entire city of Varanasi, Lord Vishnu's Sudarshana Chakra returned to the side of Sri Krishna, whose actions are effortless. Any mortal who recounts this heroic pastime of Lord Uttama's shlokas, or who simply hears it attentively, will become free from all sins. Thus end the purports of the humble servants of His Divine Grace, Sri Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, to the 10th canto, 66th chapter of Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled Vandraka, the False Vasudeva. So as we reach the end of this chapter, I'd like to just review a few points that were presented in this chapter regarding our conception of God. And indeed, that's what we'll talk about in the class today, different conceptions about God, what it means. We all may believe in God, but we may be believing in different gods, so try to understand a little bit what it means, different conceptions of God. But the reason why I wanted to go back over some of these things is because my own conception of God was very much struck by this chapter in the Krishna book, the first time I read it. I can still remember right now being out on Sankirtan at a stoplight in Annapolis, Maryland, thinking about this pastime that we had read before going on Sankirtan that day, because it struck me so much. 4 points, actually two, but two instances of each of these things. First, we have this picture of God as being in the assembly, and when the messenger of Pondraka came to give, you know, the challenge to Krishna, to Vasudev, the real Vasudev, how Krishna and all the members of the assembly laughed very loudly. They laughed very loudly, and Prabhupada says, it's not in the Sanskrit actually, but Prabhupada said they laughed loudly for a considerable amount of time. They were laughing. That image just struck me so much, even to this day. It's a very vivid, kind of different conception of God. I mean, God just like having a belly laugh and bending over and everyone just, you know, practically rolling on the floor with laughter in the assembly. Quite an interesting conception. And that's not the only time, because when Krishna finally went on the when Pondraka came and Krishna went out to meet him on the battlefield, when he actually saw him, he also couldn't check his laughter. He was actually seeing him, you know, with the obvious imitation. Prabhupada, you know, he describes it very nicely, that it was obviously an imitation, how he was made up. Let's see if I can see it, because they quote Prabhupada's purport here. When Lord Krishna, on the whole, Pondraka's dress and makeup were clearly imitation. Anyone can understand that he was just like someone on a stage playing the part of Vasudeva in false dress. When Lord Sri Krishna saw Pondraka imitating his posture and dress, he could not check his laughter, and thus he laughed with great satisfaction. So, again, he had a good laugh. It wasn't just enough in the assembly house, but... And it's interesting here, imitating his posture and dress. Could you imagine? You know, he's like going to throw the disc, so he's like, cut some pose, you know, like, hilarious, you know, hilarious. Yeah, two extra arms. It was just amazing. But this is God. I mean, God, at least we're asked to believe in this God, accept this God, that he's laughing, having such a good time. And also, there's two other points on the other side here. The way Krishna spoke to him, both to the messenger and then in person, also is sort of surprising for God, because he sort of like played along. Okay, you want my disc? Well, here it is. Be careful. He told him like that. Be careful. I'm going to give it to you. So we might think about God, we think of him all-powerful, all-majestic, and how does he sort of descend to this kind of banter with somebody like Pondraka? But he did. He told him, be careful. And he also told the messenger, he said to him something very amazing. He said, I directly call him a rascal. He said like that, you know, Go tell your rascal master that I directly call him a rascal. Of course, that maybe a lot of it has to do with the word rascal. Little rascals. Whatever. But yeah, that word is such a, it's a foreign word to, in a sense, especially coming from the mouth of God, a rascal. But these things give us an image of Krishna, and indeed that's the purpose of the Srimad Bhagavatam, especially the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, that we get some understanding, a personal look at who is God, and what he does, and what he likes, what he doesn't like, is described very in great detail in the 10th, and the whole Srimad Bhagavatam, but the 10th canto in particularly. So, Kalakanta Prabhu, you may know, he has a book he wrote called A God That Dances. It's a sort of, it's a versification of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. But I think he chose that title, A God Who Dances, for the same kind of reason, that this is our conception of God, that he dances, that he jokes, he laughs, which is quite different, quite a different conception of God than many conceptions out there. Let's just talk about some of the different conceptions of God are there, because when we talk about God, I think we have to realize that maybe people may be thinking differently about what that term means and how to apply it to, and who to apply it to. There are many acceptances of a supreme being, a supreme controller, or a supreme spirit out there, and it takes different forms, and people call that worship of God. For instance, in the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, we find a description of many different powerful creatures or occurrences in nature that some people worship as God. And I think you'll find in different cultures or civilizations or maybe uncivilized societies around the world where people worship, Prabhupada says, a tree, for instance. They worship a tree, or they worship a mountain, because there's a certain amount of power or majesty in these things, and people associate that with God, and therefore they humble themselves, they offer worship, homage, to expressions of great power that we find in nature. Now, a lot of time that's motivated by sort of a type of fear that if we don't please the gods, the god of the tree, the god of rain, the god of the mountain, then something bad might happen to us. And so their worship of God, of these, the power we find in nature, is based in fear. And so that's certainly acceptance of a supreme being. And worship to some degree, but how does it, you know, rank in terms of other understandings of God? That's the point. It's all centered in material existence, and it's based, as I say, in fear. So that's one way to accept God, the supreme being, the power in nature. Another conception about God is that God is who supplies all of our necessities. Now, I don't mean to suggest that we, in our conception of God, when we get to that here in this list, don't have elements of some of these same things. That's there. Just like God as a supplier of the necessities of our necessities in life. That's also described in Bhagavad Gita in the third chapter, where karma, the karmakanda sort of section of the Vedas is summarized. People worship God in the form of demigods, for instance, and those demigods are meant to supply their necessities. They pray to a supreme being, a supreme controller, to get their necessities of life. As I say, karmakanda is full of these things, and therefore people worship the demigods. And so that's a conception of God that is not just in the Vedic system of worshiping demigods, even in some forms of Christianity, this is prominent, that if you worship God, you'll get prosperity. And so it's all based on this kind of a need, needs relationship with the Supreme Lord. Again, these are things which are, so let's say, within the material sphere and understanding God within the material sphere. If we move to the spiritual basis, say a more spiritual conception, we find what is common in our study, we find Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan, different ways in which people worship God. Some people accept God, a supreme controller, a uniting force of everything that happens in this world, the fabric that underlies the entire creation we see around us, or Brahman. Some people worship Brahman as God or as the supreme. And almost sort of a negation of the material world, that there's a spiritual reality, and that spiritual reality has none of the characteristics of the material variety that we see around us here. And so some people accept Brahman as God. So it's another conception of God that's out there. Brahman, then there's Paramatma. Paramatma is the knower, the controller, the doer behind everything, the personal, the localized personality of Godhead, who's in our hearts, who's in every atom, who's directing this the world and directing all of us. Paramatma is also another conception that's there of God, who is God, the all-knowing, all-controlling being that's in the heart of all living entities. That's a conception of God as well. And again, not something that we reject. We don't even reject Brahman, but we see it in relation to Bhagavan, which is a further development or in the conception of who is God, Bhagavan. It's interesting that how these different forms of God are made of, are motivated or known. I mentioned fear, need, a sort of a negation for the Brahman. Paramatma, individualized. What is that, Krishna? And Bhagavan. Bhagavan, or the personal form of God, full of all opulences. We know the definition. Full of all strength, fame, knowledge, renunciation, beauty. It's interesting that Bhagavan, the Bhagavan realization of God, and this is where we're starting to get close to our conception of God. Bhagavan realization of God is known only by devotion. Only by devotion can you know this form, this conception of God. And that's our process, in a sense. Why am I fascinated with the laughing of God? You know, because we're taught that we should try to know and understand the personal features of God and how he interacts with his devotees. There's an interesting analysis that Srila Jiva Goswami gives about this word Bhagavan. We're all familiar with the definition that I just talked about, full of all strength, knowledge, fame, renunciation, like that. Aishvara Yasha Samagrasya Vira Yasha Yasasa Shriya. That verse from the Vishnu Purana. But there's another way that's presented in the Bhagavat Sandarbha by Srila Jiva Goswami of understanding this word Bhagavan, and it goes to breaking up the syllables, like Bhagavan. What do they mean? And how do they indicate? What kind of conception of God does it give? So I found it very interesting. I'll share it with you here. Oh, he quotes it in Upanishad. Yeah. So, three things, ba. Ba has similarity with the root brin, which means to support, to nourish. And so, the relationship, the personal relationship between the living entity and God, Bhagavan, is characterized by this nourishment. The devotion of the individual jiva soul with God, the relationship is based on God nourishing the individual soul by personal dealings, by loving exchanges. One's bhakti, or love for the Supreme Lord, is nourished by Bhagavan, by him taking this role of nourishing and supporting by loving exchanges. Has a similarity with the root gam, which means to go or to send. And so Bhagavan means he who sends his devotee back to the spiritual world, sends his devotee to his own abode. And van has a root similarity with root vasa, which means to live. And so vasa means that he lives, the Bhagavan lives in the heart of the devotee. He lives there and is his constant companion like that. And so Bhagavan, the Bhagavan conception of God is a very personal one in which one has a personal relationship with the Supreme Lord. And it's interesting that this Bhagavan, we get to the level of Bhagavan realization of God, it's completely out of anything to do with the material world. It only has to do with his activities in the spiritual world. There's no, even the Paramatma, is present in the material world. He pervades the material world. There's no Paramatma in the spiritual realm. And so Bhagavan means his own activities outside of anything to do with creation and maintenance of this world altogether. It just has to do with him. He's a person. He has his own abode. He has his own activities. He has his own relationships, none of which have to do necessarily with creation or maintenance of this world. And in that world of his own, with his own identity, his own activities, his own being, he has this type of a relationship, devotional relationship with his individual devotees. So that's our conception of God. Our conception of God and why we worship him as God is beyond all material motivation. And it's centered in our eternal spiritual, completely spiritual relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And even within that type of relationship, there are more distinctions to be made. Two in particular, in a broad way. A devotional relationship with Bhagavan in terms of Aishwarya, or great opulence or majesty, and a devotional relationship with Bhagavan based on sweetness or intimacy. So our conception of God as followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and as Gaudiya Vaishnavas is beyond this Aishwarya conception of a relationship with God. Aishwarya means the power and majesty of the Lord that we see, for instance, in Vaikuntha, in the Vaikuntha planets where there's Vishnu. There's a relationship of knowledge and love of the Supreme Lord, but intimacy is lacking. In Goloka Vrindavan, however, if we go to that conception, we find a higher conception, and it's higher because it's more personal. There's more of a personal relationship. When we say we accept God as a person, we really mean it, and we take it all the way to the point of having a personal relationship with Him, personal, a very sweet, interactive personal relationship with Him, not just that power and majesty, Aishwarya and Vaikuntha. But no, we want to go to Goloka Vrindavan, where there is intimacy in relationship with Krishna, the form of Krishna. And why that's the topmost is because there, not only is there knowledge and love for the Supreme Lord, but the Supreme Lord Himself becomes conquered by His devotee. He becomes conquered by the love of the devotee. He becomes, although he's the supreme in all the aspects that we've read or talked about, all the way from the very beginning of the power in the world, he becomes conquered by the love of his devotee. That's why Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Because he becomes conquered by his devotee. By the love of his devotee. So much so that, as described in the verses here today, it is related, by the way, to the verses today. text number 42, the last line of that, the Sanskrit in that verse, Krishnasya Klishta Karmana. It means Sri Krishna, whose actions are effortless. Whose actions are effortless. By the power and majesty and opulence of the Supreme Lord, His actions are effortless. Whatever He wants is automatically done. This is Aishwarya. We read the verse, Aishwaryasya Yashasastriya. Ishvara. By His supreme, he's such a supreme and complete controller that just by desiring it, something is done. He doesn't have to do anything. Personally, it's automatically done. That means whatever actions, his actions are effortless. Alista, aklista, without trouble or fatigue. He doesn't have to do anything. His shaktis are so complete and are ready to serve him that whatever slight desire he has is immediately fulfilled. But his energies act in such a way that they're so wonderful that they sometimes even bewilder him. They act in such wonderful ways. And one example is when his friends were going into the mouth of Agasura. Krishna was observing how his Leela Shakti, his pastime potency, was acting so wonderfully that he was astonished by it. He was stunned, actually. He was thinking, oh my goodness, how How wonderful the Leela Shakti is working here. And he had to think what he was going to do. And so similarly, Leela Shakti is working so perfectly that here in this pastime with Pondraka, Krishna was playing chess, and he didn't want to give up playing chess. And so therefore, just by his Leela Shakti potency, Sudarshan got his orders and burned down the city and took care of the fiery demon, and Krishna could just enjoy playing chess with his devotees. And without any effort to protect his devotees from the fiery demon, the efforts. So this is the type of, when we say we worship God, we worship Krishna in a loving relationship, which is the topmost way that we can relate to God and how he wants to relate to us. So that opportunity is given to us by Srila Prabhupada, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Srimad Bhagavatam, and all the great devotees. And all we have to do is make an effort. We do have to make an effort to hear, though, not necessarily to do, but just to hear. And if we engage ourselves in hearing about this conception of God, then we'll attain that perfection gradually, without fail. So these are something on different conceptions of God. Does anybody have any questions or comments they'd like to make about Damodar Prabhu?
In the Bhagavad Gita, the Chatras, they all went out to the battlefield and everyone was killed, but no women and children were killed. But here, in the Sudarshan Chakra, and in the city, it seems all the women, children, old men, animals all be injured and killed. Doesn't that seem rather unchatry-like?
It's interesting because it mentions the, it doesn't mention people when it says how the city was destroyed. But let's just say that they were. Now, Krishna's act, we can, by analogy, refer to other examples of Krishna's behavior. Say, like, on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, where people came to fight, and they did die. They were meant to. But what happened to all those people that died in the presence of Krishna? What happened to them? Was it something bad that happened to them? Sure, they had to give up their body. We have to do that anyway. But what happened? They're all liberated. They're all liberated. And this is a special feature of Krishna, that when he kills someone, even his enemies, they get liberated. So let's say people were killed in the town here, but it's Lord Vishnu's disc that's doing the killing. They're getting benefited by that. Now, that may be hard to understand. But if we have a background in the science of Krishna consciousness, knowing from the instructions of Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna tells Arjuna, he's telling him to kill him, to fight on the battlefield, but he said that you should know that no one can kill or the soul. If you're thinking you're killing the soul, you're making a mistake. And so he teaches them whole knowledge of Bhagavad Gita about the spirit soul, how the soul can never be killed. And so if there were people killed in Varanasi when all this destruction took place, then they were ultimately benefited. Their souls were ultimately benefited by being liberated by the actions of the Lord. So there's never a downside to interaction with Krishna, even if it means giving up this body, which you all have to do anyway. Yes.
It's all right. There's a verse in Bhagavatam 3, 28:33 that has to do with the laughter of Lord Vishnu. Is it all right if I read it?
Mm-hmm.
It says, with devotion steeped in love and affection, the yogi should meditate within the core of his heart upon the laughter of Lord Vishnu. Laughter of Lord Vishnu is so captivating that it can be easily meditated upon. When the Supreme Lord is laughing, one can see his small teeth, which resemble jasmine buds, reddened rosy by the splendor of his lips. Once devoting his mind to this, the yogi should no longer desire to see anything else. Mm. And in Prabhupada's purport, he has a very, I'll just read one line of it. Two lines. It is described herein that one should meditate upon the laughter or smiling of Vishnu. There is no other activity that can completely cleanse the heart of the devotee.
Such a pleasing way to perform service to Krishna. Maharaj.
Hare Krishna. I have too many things, so I'll just try to pick out something briefly. On the smiling topic, some of us may recall in a Nectar of Devotion, is it? There's a whole science of that. And different levels of laughter show, like more of the teeth show, and that someone's really laughing out loud, and the teeth show more, different levels of smiling, hasa, or laughing. I hope I get this right because I present this a lot when you were talking about the distinction between Brahman, Paramatma, and then Bhagavan. That Bhagavan is beyond this world and Brahman. So I tried to suggest that the Brahman and Paramatma reveal the immanence or the how Krishna is within everything, even in this world. Whereas Bhagavan is more his transcendental aspect. Bhagavan is beyond this world. You can also, maybe we can go so far as to say that Brahman and Paramatma are more in line with the oneness, the Abheda, whereas the Bhagavan is more the Beta. It's more the difference. So it's beyond this world, which helps us to understand Bhagavad Gita 9, 4, and 5, is it? Or 3 and 4? 9, 4, and 5. When I was speaking last night, I was suggesting also that although we, as Gaudiya Vaishnavas, we're aiming for the more intimate relationship with the Lord and on the level of Vrindavan, but practically speaking, many of us, I was suggesting it's wholesome, for instance, to appreciate the opulence of the Lord, the majestic feature. Maybe not for all of us, but for many of us, I know for myself, that we may still, for instance, or even what you were mentioning, God is the order supplier. Not that we shouldn't take it in an offensive way, that that's his only role is to serve me. There's a book called God is My Co-Pilot, about a World War II pilot or something like that. But rather, I don't see it's necessary to completely, boycott that type of understanding, because as we go about our daily activities, I know in the 90s, even as a brahmachari, I was doing business, and you really think that you're the doer. I mean, you really, you know, it's hard to always remember that although it seems like I'm a doer, but actually Krishna's giving the intelligence if he chooses to do so. He's providing the materials. In other words, these lesser, you might say, or more preliminary or less developed conceptions of God and our relationship with Him. It seems that it has its use. There's stepping stones that we still need to support ourselves on as we simultaneously try to cultivate the sweet aspect also. Is that a reasonable proposal?
Yeah, I think that is the proposal. Like the description is there about how things are cumulative, just like the earth. Earth has, what is it, form, smell, taste, you know, whatever. You start with the elements, and one ether has space or whatever, and then you add the element, you get the complete earth, which has all five of the elements. And so realization of Krishna is like that. Even the rasas with Krishna, they all contain, like Madhurya rasa contains all the others, elements of others in them. So when you're tasting the fullness of the conjugal relationship with Krishna, it has all the others within it. And so, yes, all the different conceptions of God are not cast away as we move through them, as we try to move toward the highest understanding and conception of God, but rather they build, as you say, like a stepping staircase.
Although the rasas may include other rasas, but of course at that point you want to distance, you tend to distance yourself from conceptions of beyond rasas. I mean, what I was referring to is other, and you were referring to other conceptions of God, which are quite, you might say, pedestrian compared to that nectar.
The opulence definitely, as they say, shrinks the ability to have an intimate relationship with his opulence. So Aishwarya shrinks the loving capacity.
Then there's a book by, I think, Gaur Govinda Maharaj called Mathura Meets Vrindavan, where he's showing how there is actually lots of opulence in in Goloka and Vrindavan. But that's subordinated to the sweetness. Sweetness is so much that even though there's all that opulence, it's not prominent.
This point about having fear, and that's some kind of a motivation for approaching God. It does seem, though, even for practicing devotees, like there's this one section in the chapter, the 11th canto, right after the Krishna Varnam Tusha Krishnam verse, where there's a description of how in Kali Yuga the suffering that individuals undergo is so intense that they're forced to take shelter of the holy name. So suffering and fear and stress, but it does seem like it plays kind of a fairly substantial role for us. I know myself, when I'm stressed out, and if I really take shelter of the holy name, then Krishna personally kind of clears the misconceptions that I'm carrying that create the distress. I mean, that get me all stressed out, puts me into a more sane condition. And then in that way, experience Krishna's presence in my life, that he just like clears it. I just cry to the holy name and then he comes and, he shows you the way. How to, not be on the fear platform, not help you get off of the material platform. But it seems like it is a motivation to some extent for us, at least on a neophyte level.
All of these things that we talked about here are relating to God. People are trying to understand God, so we're not talking about kicking him off and not that they're no good or something. Actually, I was on a morning walk with Prabhupada in Mayapur one time, and there, at that time there were ditches and everything, and so we were going across the field, and there was a ditch, and somebody helped Prabhupada up the bank of the ditch, and threw their hand away like that. Just threw it away. He said, that's how the Mayavadis are. They take the help of the guru, and then they just throw it away, and reject. But that's not what we're talking about here with these different conceptions of God. They're conceptions of God, after all, and so they're good. We want people to believe in God. But what believing in God means should be clarified, and what's the highest belief in God, relationship with God, is what we're just trying to present in a comparative way, not that they're not necessary. Anything else in the next? Not to ask you my bhagavatam.